What if everything you thought you knew about American economic history was wrong? Contrary to popular belief, the United States didn't become the world's economic superpower through unfettered free markets and minimal government intervention. Instead, America's remarkable economic success story has been driven by pragmatic government policies that repeatedly reshaped the economy, opening new spaces for entrepreneurial energy to flourish. This forgotten history is what Stephen Cohen and Bradford DeLong resurrect in Concrete Economics, a book that has become required reading in policy circles from Washington to Beijing. Even Warren Buffett reportedly keeps a copy on his nightstand, appreciating its clear-eyed view of how economies actually develop rather than how theories suggest they should. The book's influence extends beyond business leaders to politicians across the spectrum who recognize that America's current economic challenges demand a return to pragmatic problem-solving rather than ideological purity. The standard narrative of American economic history portrays the United States as inherently Jeffersonian, a nation of self-sufficient pioneers and entrepreneurs distrustful of government interference. This popular but fundamentally mistaken view ignores how the federal government deliberately shaped America's economy from its earliest days. From infrastructure policy to monetary policy, the federal government's invisible hand guided American economic development in ways that continue to influence policy debates today. Alexander Hamilton, America's first Treasury Secretary, didn't just accept the young nation's comparative advantage in agriculture. He actively sought to transform it through a comprehensive economic system built around four mutually reinforcing elements: high tariffs on imports, substantial infrastructure spending, federal assumption of states' Revolutionary War debts, and the creation of a central bank. This system, detailed in his famous Report on Manufactures, 1791, laid out a vision of America as an industrial powerhouse rather than merely an agricultural supplier to European powers. Hamilton's protectionist policies weren't timid. America implemented a 25% tariff in 1816, which climbed to about 35% by the mid-19th century. These tariffs remained among the highest in the North Atlantic for over a century, only declining after World War II when America assumed global leadership. While economists today often criticize protectionism, these policies successfully shielded America's infant industries from British competition, allowing them to grow into global powerhouses. Industries like textiles in New England, steel in Pennsylvania, and machinery in Ohio flourished under this protective umbrella. The government didn't just protect industries, it actively developed them. The Springfield Arsenal became a laboratory for high-tech innovations, creating breakthroughs like the American system of manufacturing with standardized parts. This approach spread throughout the economy, evolving into mass production and Fordism that would later define American industrial might. The government also funded crucial infrastructure projects like the Erie Canal, which reduced transportation costs between the Midwest and East Coast by 90%, and the Transcontinental Railroad, which knitted the nation together economically. Hamilton's vision triumphed so completely that even his political opponents found themselves unable to dismantle his system once in power. James Madison, who initially argued for limited government in the 1790s, later established the Second Bank of the United States as president because he recognized it would make the country more prosperous. Thomas Jefferson himself, despite his agrarian ideals, expanded federal power through the Louisiana Purchase and other initiatives. The National Road, begun under Jefferson, exemplified how even anti-federalists came to embrace Hamilton's vision of government-led development. By century's end, America had transformed from an agricultural backwater into the world's largest industrial power, overtaking free trade Britain and proving that deliberate economic redesign could achieve what natural evolution could not. This transformation vindicated Hamilton's belief that strategic government intervention could accelerate economic development. The success of this model influenced later industrializing nations like Germany and Japan, who similarly used state power to catch up with more advanced economies. Lincoln's Republicans didn't just end slavery and preserve the Union, they implemented a comprehensive economic redesign that built upon Hamilton's framework while opening vast new economic spaces. Their ideology centered on free labor, not just opposing slavery as evil, but actively supporting workers through government policies. The Republican economic program strengthened tariffs dramatically, raising them from 23% in 1846 to 50% during the Civil War. With Southern Democrats largely absent from the governing coalition after secession, these high tariffs became central to American policy, just as American manufacturers were becoming global powerhouses. While Europe embraced free trade, with England at 0%, Germany at 4-6%, and France at 12-15%, America maintained 50% tariffs that proved politically popular outside the South. Perhaps most transformative was the massive railroad expansion. 200,000 miles of privately owned but publicly subsidized track that reshaped America's economic geography. The government granted 180 million acres of prime public land to railroad companies, enabling them to connect the East, open the West, and drive vast increases in output and productivity. These railroads fueled innovation in steel, coal, machinery, and agriculture, while enabling new business models like Sears, Roebuck & Co.'s catalog, and Swift & Company's disassembly line for meat processing. The Republicans also passed the Homestead Act of 1862, allowing any adult who hadn't fought against the Union to claim 160 acres of federal land by living on and improving it for 5 years. Rather than auctioning land to the highest bidders, which might have created a Russian or Latin American-style society of huge landholdings with peasant laborers, the government deliberately created independent farmers, a social design that echoed a century later in America's mass suburbanization program. Even the modern corporation represented an extraordinary redefinition of property rights, created pragmatically to accommodate the new economic reality. Limited liability, the defining feature that meant owners weren't responsible for corporate debts beyond their share value, was a striking restriction on creditors' rights designed to facilitate large-scale equity financing. Post-Civil War Republican judges and legislators expanded corporate privileges, granting them constitutional protections and special bankruptcy provisions that kept systemically important firms running rather than liquidating them. When giant corporations, trusts, came to dominate the economy in the late 19th century, Theodore Roosevelt recognized that markets weren't working as theory suggested they should. Though initially speaking like a typical Republican, denouncing even mild reforms as communism, Roosevelt abandoned rigid ideology for pragmatic reform after McKinley's assassination elevated him to the presidency in 1901. Roosevelt understood that excessive power, whether in government or wealthy hands, needed balancing. He led a progressive coalition willing to work across party lines, even splitting the Republican Party in 1912 rather than seeing his successor, Taft, whom he viewed as captured by moneyed interests, win re-election. The progressive movement addressed 5 major dysfunctions: prairie populism, born of deflation and monopolistic price gouging; unassimilated immigrants in corrupt urban machines; the backward ex-Confederate South; massive corporate trusts controlling markets; and the extreme wealth inequality of the Gilded Age. Between 1890-1925, progressives implemented reforms including the Federal Reserve, the Interstate Commerce Commission, monopoly breakups, consumer protections, and the income tax. When the Great Depression hit, Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal represented emergency treatment for a devastated economy rather than a new economic space. With 1/3 of non-farm workers unemployed, 1/2 of mortgages in default, and banks failing nationwide, Roosevelt promised immediate action, not miracle cures. The New Deal embodied pragmatic experimentalism, trying multiple approaches simultaneously, expanding what worked and abandoning what didn't. Banks were closed with a holiday, then reopened days later with new legislation. The Homeowners Loan Corporation refinanced over 1 million mortgages in 2 years. Financial regulation followed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Job creation came through agencies like the Civilian Conservation Corps and Works Progress Administration, while massive infrastructure projects transformed the West with the world's largest dams. Despite doubling federal spending, Roosevelt remained reluctant about deficits, even cutting them in 1937, causing a prompt economic downturn. The New Deal focused on emergency repair, humanitarian measures, redistribution, and financial control, not opening new economic spaces. Though not ideological but pragmatic, it ironically became the definition of post-war American liberalism. Eisenhower's vision represented a full-blown consensus shared across American society, not a break with the past, but an extension of where Roosevelt and Truman had led. This vision formed a triptych. At center, the American dream of suburban homes with modern appliances and automobiles. On the right, military might to protect that dream through technological superiority. On the left, civilian benefits from government-funded science and technology. This comprehensive approach reflected the optimistic spirit of the 1950s and the belief that American prosperity could be scientifically engineered. Federal efforts to promote homeownership began under Hoover but truly flourished under Roosevelt's New Deal. The Homeowners Loan Corporation and Federal Housing Administration revolutionized mortgage financing with long-term fixed rates, low down payments, and government guarantees. The GI Bill added generous mortgage assistance for veterans, often with zero down payments. These programs transformed homeownership from a privilege of the wealthy to an achievable goal for millions of working-class Americans. By 1960, the homeownership rate had risen to 61.9% compared to 43.6% in 1940. Government policy deliberately shaped America into a suburban nation, with FHA insurance favoring single-family homes over apartments by a ratio of 7-1. The 1956 National Defense Highway Act, the largest public works program between the Egyptian pyramids and China's modern urbanization, created 41,000 miles of highways with 90% federal funding, with two-thirds built within metropolitan areas. This massive infrastructure project not only connected cities, but fundamentally reshaped American geography, making previously rural areas accessible for suburban development. Communities like Levittown, New York, and Park Forest, Illinois, became prototypes for mass-produced suburban living. This suburban expansion created a physically segregated but psychologically unified middle-class America, where status was differentiated by degree rather than kind. Americans shared similar consumption patterns, watched the same television networks, used the same products, and considered themselves part of one middle-class nation, albeit a white one. The suburban lifestyle became synonymous with the American dream, complete with standardized ranch houses, manicured lawns, and two-car garages. Major retailers like Sears and Montgomery Ward catered to this new market with identical product lines nationwide. The dark side of this suburban dream was its racial exclusivity. By 1960, Levittown's 82,000 residents were all white, a result of deliberate government policy. The FHA, America's largest property insurer, mandated homogeneous, segregated neighborhoods in its appraisal forms, even supplying templates for racist restrictive covenants. Federal housing and transportation programs concentrated on racially restricted suburbs, propelling white families outward while trapping African Americans in what became known as the inner city. This systematic discrimination created lasting patterns of residential segregation and wealth inequality. The practice of redlining, marking minority neighborhoods as high risk for loans, effectively denied Black Americans access to the wealth-building opportunities of homeownership, creating economic disparities that would persist for generations. The truly transformative digital environment we inhabit today was launched during the Eisenhower Consensus era, with nearly all key technologies spinning out from federal research, development, and procurement programs. While Silicon Valley entrepreneurs brilliantly adapted and applied these technologies, they rarely invented the foundational elements. This pattern of government-led innovation, followed by private sector commercialization, became the defining characteristic of America's technological advancement in the 20th century. The Pentagon's role in semiconductor development was particularly decisive. Through strategic investments and procurement policies, it drove semiconductor technology development and created a robust, competitive American industry. The firms that would eventually give Silicon Valley its name, Fairchild, Intel, National Semiconductor, and AMD, all emerged from this ecosystem. In the early years, the Pentagon purchased an astounding 95% of total production at premium prices, effectively subsidizing the industry's growth. Most significantly, the Pentagon's unusual dual-sourcing procurement policy required multiple suppliers for critical components, deliberately forcing technology diffusion and preventing monopolistic control. This approach created a dynamic market structure characterized by numerous agile firms competing through rapid innovation. The computer age's origins were deeply rooted in military research. ENIAC, funded by the Army Research Laboratory in 1946, marked the beginning, followed by the Navy's ambitious Project Whirlwind. When Whirlwind faced technical challenges, it evolved into SAGE, the Air Force's comprehensive radar station network. SAGE's total costs exceeded even the Manhattan Project, making it one of the most expensive military programs of its era. Though the system became strategically obsolete with the advent of satellite technology, SAGE's development yielded crucial innovations that transformed computing. Magnetic core memory, digital phone line transmission, and real-time software systems. These advances converted computing from an academic curiosity into an economic powerhouse and established IBM's global dominance for decades to come. The Internet's military origins are equally compelling. Created by DARPA, established after Sputnik's launch to maintain American technological superiority, the network, initially called DARPANET, relied on revolutionary pocket switching technology developed by Pentagon-funded researchers in the early 1960s. The fundamental TCP/IP protocols, which still form the Internet's backbone, were developed by Vinton Cerf at DARPA and Robert Kahn, who later became DARPA's director. The final piece of the modern internet puzzle, HTML, emerged not from Silicon Valley, but from Timothy Berners-Lee at CERN, the European government-funded physics laboratory, demonstrating the continued importance of public research institutions. The government's technological influence extended beyond digital realms. Commercial aviation's transformation illustrates this perfectly. Boeing's successful bid for the KC-135 Stratotanker contract, designed for mid-flight refueling, provided crucial Pentagon financing for advanced aviation development. The revolutionary Boeing 707 commercial jetliner was essentially a civilian adaptation of the KC-135, both derived from the Boeing 36780 prototype. This military-to-civilian technology transfer enabled Boeing's remarkable market dominance, transforming from a non-player with 0% of the U.S. commercial aircraft market in 1958 to controlling an overwhelming 92% by 1964, fundamentally reshaping global aviation. The East Asian development model, though invented in America by Hamilton, was implemented by Bismarck's Germany, transplanted to East Asia by Japan, adopted by Korea, and scaled massively by China. This model has delivered unprecedented rapid growth while reshaping the American economy as a byproduct. Japan pioneered the modern Asian development model, achieving the fastest sustained growth of any major economy in world history. From 1960-1973, Japan maintained an astonishing 10% annual growth rate, quadrupling its economy and raising per capita GDP from 25% to 57% of America's level. even from 1973-1990, despite oil shocks and trade restrictions, Japan grew at 4.5% annually, reaching 78% of American per capita GDP. America tolerated Japan's industrial policy regime primarily due to Cold War strategic considerations. Japan needed to be prosperous, stable, and tightly allied with the United States as a democratic bulwark against communism in East Asia. Even when Japanese exports began decimating American industries from Pittsburgh to Detroit to Silicon Valley, the U.S. government largely ignored domestic complaints. China has pushed this development model to its limits through its system-bursting scale. Under Deng Xiaoping's pragmatic leadership starting in the late 1970s, China initiated controllable experiments in bounded areas. The reforms began with agriculture, dismantling communes, returning farms to peasants, and implementing a dual price structure that quickly boosted agricultural output. With limited domestic demand, exports became crucial for absorbing factory output and enabling learning by doing. Unlike Japan, which kept foreign companies out, China invited them in but required Chinese partners who ensured technology and know-how quickly transferred to Chinese hands. This approach enabled remarkably rapid advancement in sophisticated sectors like high-speed trains, solar panels, and networking equipment. The U.S.-China trade balance shows a massive imbalance. In 2011, $129 billion in U.S. exports to China versus $411 billion in imports, creating a $282 billion deficit representing potentially 3 million American jobs. When measured by value added rather than gross trade, the deficit shrinks to about $141 billion, still substantial both economically and politically. As manufacturing declined from 21% of GDP in 1979 to just 12% by 2007, finance expanded from 3.7% of the economy in the 1950s to over 8.5% today, a major economic reshaping through policy that went largely unannounced. The cost of America's financial system has ballooned from about 1.2% of total financial assets per year in the 1950s to nearly 3% today, while compensation in finance has risen from parity with other sectors to four times higher. Financial firms' profits exploded from 10 to 15% of total corporate profits in the post-war years to nearly 50% at their 2007 peak. Yet despite this massive growth, the economy hasn't seen faster growth than in the 1950s-60s or more rapid structural transformation than in earlier periods. As economist Thomas Philippon notes, today's finance industry doesn't seem more efficient at transferring funds from savers to borrowers than the industry of 1910, despite all its technological advances. This financial boom actually retarded broader economic growth. Since finance provides only intermediary services rather than ultimate value, its hypertrophy diverts resources from productive sectors. The financial sector disproportionately benefits low-productivity projects with easily pledged collateral, like construction, while drawing skilled workers away from entrepreneurship and innovation. Manufacturing sectors dependent on R&D or external financing suffer particularly when finance booms. Financial deregulation wasn't a sudden policy shift, but died by 1,000 small cuts beginning in the 1970s when investment banks were first allowed to publicly list their equity shares. This transformed them from risk-conscious partnerships to institutions that would all have failed in 2008 without government rescue. The deregulatory movement began with Alfred Kahn's successful reforms of transportation under Carter, which correctly addressed dysfunctional airline price controls but expanded uncritically to finance. As the memory of the Great Depression faded among financial professionals, so did the institutional caution that had characterized the industry. Simultaneously, economic thinking shifted dramatically. Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz's influential work convinced policymakers that the Federal Reserve could prevent depressions simply by properly managing the money supply, making tight regulatory controls seem unnecessary. What had once been seen as essential firebreaks against financial panic were reframed as barriers to capital access. This wasn't merely Republican deregulation. Even the Congressional Black Caucus supported subprime lending as a means to expand home ownership. The result was predictable: speculative manias and crashes in 2000 and 2008, with the latter triggering a severe recession. The ideological turn in American economic policy beginning in the 1980s represented a profound break from America's pragmatic economic tradition. Rather than concrete goals for reshaping the economy, we pursued abstract ideological principles like unfettered free markets and trickle-down economics. The result? High finance churning, real estate transacting, and healthcare claims processing replaced manufacturing as economic pillars, activities that were busy but useless, empty but still flabby. This shift led to the hollowing out of America's industrial base, with cities like Detroit, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh bearing the brunt of manufacturing decline. Throughout American history, successful economic redesign shared a common feature. They weren't guided by ideology or abstract theory, but by pragmatism, what works in concrete, real-world conditions. From Hamilton's establishment of a national banking system through Lincoln's Transcontinental Railroad and land-grant colleges, Roosevelt's New Deal programs, and Eisenhower's interstate highway system, the government consciously and pragmatically led the way in opening economic spaces that entrepreneurs then rushed into, innovated within, and expanded. Each of these initiatives created entirely new markets and opportunities for private enterprise. The authors don't advocate replacing one ideology with another. Instead, they call for returning to America's successful tradition of pragmatic, concrete economic policy, what Keynes called handling problems on its merits in detail without ideological presumptions. This means evaluating policies based on their measurable outcomes rather than their adherence to theoretical frameworks. For instance, rather than debating the abstract merits of government intervention, we should ask, will this specific infrastructure project create jobs? Will this particular research investment spark innovation? The essential change is simple to understand but difficult to implement. Shift economic policy discussions from abstract ideology to concrete, imageable proposals where Americans can envision, this is the kind of thing we will get. This means moving beyond vague promises of growth or efficiency to specific, tangible outcomes like new high-speed rail lines connecting major cities, advanced manufacturing facilities producing next-generation solar panels, or research centers developing breakthrough medical technologies. What might such a redesign look like? It would likely include rebuilding aging bridges and upgrading ports, investing in quantum computing research and advanced material science, developing grid-scale energy storage and small modular nuclear reactors, reforming healthcare delivery through telemedicine and AI diagnostics, and creating incentives for reshoring critical manufacturing capabilities in semiconductors and pharmaceuticals. But the specific policies matter less than the approach. Pragmatic problem-solving focused on concrete outcomes rather than ideological purity. The lesson of American economic history is clear. When government and entrepreneurs work together pragmatically, with government opening new economic spaces and entrepreneurs rushing in to innovate, America prospers. The interstate highway system didn't just create roads, it enabled entirely new business models from fast food to big box retail. When ideology replaces pragmatism, we falter. The choice before us isn't between more government or less government, but between effective government and ineffective government, between concrete economics and abstract ideology. The path forward requires abandoning rigid doctrines and embracing what works, measured by real improvements in American lives and livelihoods.